Yeah, we have Parkas Kiseisei. You probably noticed, has the largest number of mitzvos of any parsha in the Torah. There's more than 50 mitzvos out of 613 that are in Kiseisei, and many of them are new. They're not repeated anywhere else in the Torah. So as a result, the common statement that Chazal make, that the Book of Devarim is called Mishneh Torah, the repetition of the Torah, is not a completely accurate statement, because it does not only repeat. Some mitzvos are repeated or amplified, usually details are added, but here you certainly have mitzvos that are totally new. That's correct, but that's what I said. That in every repetition, there's going to be some amplification of detail. But there are mitzvahs that are entirely new. That there are mitzvahs that are not mentioned anywhere else in the Torah, that only appear in the Book of Devarim. So it's not entirely a mishnah. It's not entirely a repetition of the Torah. First, let me just go over something very general, which is not connected to the parsha, but it is connected to the idea of the Book of Devarim. And that is, the Gemara in Megillah says that the Book of Devarim is very different than the rest of the Torah. The rest of the Torah, the Gemara in Megillah says, is said to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words. Sefer Devarim is said to be the words of Moshe Rabbeinu himself. And the Gemara points out that Moshe Rabbeinu's words are sometimes harsher than the words of Hashem. We have two tochachas. Tochacha is the great curses, the awful, severe curses that will happen if you don't keep Hashem's mitzvahs. One tochacha is at the end of the book of Vayikra, and the other tochacha is at the end of the book of Devarim, and the Gemara in Megillah shows in various ways that the tochacha at the end of the book of Devarim is harsher than the tochacha at the end of Vayikra, because at the end of Vayikra are Hashem's words, and Hashem has more mercy. And the tochacha in Devarim is Moshe Rabbeinu's words, and that is more harsh. And the Gemara says in a number of places that the book of Devarim are Moshe Rabbeinu's own words, and that is why, indeed, throughout the whole Torah, it always says, V'daber Hashem el Moshe, Hashem speaks to Moshe. Moshe is like a third person. It's Hashem that is the narrator. In the book of Devarim, you will notice the style is, Hashem said to me, Vayedaber Hashem Eli, Hashem said to me. In the rest of the Torah, we have what is called in literature, the omniscient narrative voice. Now here, of course, it's literally the omniscient narrative voice, the anonymous narrator. In the book of Devarim, it is a first-person narrator. Now, this is what the Gemara in Megillah said. This is a Gemara. This is not anything that we could argue with directly. But the problem is, there's a real Pella here. One of the 13 principles of faith is that a person must believe that every single word, every single letter in the Torah comes from our Kodesh Baruch Hu. Specifically, if we believe that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote anything of his own, no matter how we might think insignificant, the place name, a name of a person in these lists of nichos and the like, that is apikorsis, that is kathira, that is heresy. Right? A person might not have a share in the world to come unless they do tshuva for such a thing. So how can Chazal say that a whole one-fifth of the Torah is Moshe Rabbeinu's own words? It's not God's words. Moshe Rabbeinu is piyaslo umra. So the Abarbanel, in the Hapdama to the Book of Devarim, the Abarbanel, again, is a parish, we don't necessarily mention him that much, but it's a parish that one should be aware of. Number one, the Abarbanel had a very interesting history. Just to digress for a moment, the Abarbanel is called Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. Now, Don is not the name Don, but Don was a Spanish title of nobility. And the Abarbanel lived in Spain in the 1400s, and indeed he was finance minister for Ferdinand and Isabella at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. And he was the one that raised money for Columbus's expedition to the New World. And when the Jews were expelled from Spain, unless they would convert to Christianity, and many Jews left, some Jews were burnt at the stake, and other Jews were Muranos. The Abarbanel was given an exemption. He was the one Jew that was given permission to stay and be a Jew because his financial acumen was so necessary for the success. So when it comes to money, everybody compromises, you know. But he refused, of course. And in Tisha B'Av of the year, English year 1492, Tisha B'Av was when thousands and thousands of Jews left Spain, and the Abarbanel was at the head of the line. He was already in his 70s. He was the leader of the community. In that crowd of thousands of people, there was a four-year-old child who later grew up to be Rav Yosef Karo. Right, so the Abarbanel was in his 70s. Rav Yosef Karo was a four-year-old. And Rav Yosef Karo, of course, found his way eventually to Eretz Yisrael through Constantinople, Turkey. The Abarbanel went to different places. He went to Italy, he went to Portugal, and the like. Now, the Abarbanel was a great Talmud Chacham, and he wrote voluminous commentaries on Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and some Kesuvim, although not that many Kesuvim. He was also a great philosopher. He wrote a major commentary on the Rambam's Mori Nebuchim, Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote a big parish on the Haggadah of Pesach and a big parish on Kirpi Avos. A lot of this stuff is beginning to be translated in English. The Abarbanel has a very interesting shita. The Abarbanel, which the Malbim much later followed, whenever he takes a parsha in the Chumash or a passage of the Haggadah or a part of Kirpi Avos, he always prefaces with many, many questions. He might ask 20 questions, 30 questions, 50 questions sometimes. For the Haggadah, he does 100 questions before he does the that's explaining the Haggadah, and then he offers an explanation that tries to answer all of those different questions. That is his derech in pshat. So they tell the joke about the fellow who used to like to learn the Abarbanel after he ate cholent on Shabbos afternoon, and he would read all these questions and he would fall asleep before he got the answers. So he became an apikoros because he says so many questions on the Torah. So it's dangerous. Ask too many questions without giving some answers, because then you'll think, so many contradictions here, nothing makes sense. That's why it's better, kasha teres, instead of, 100 kashas. Now, you have to know another thing about the Abarbanel that's interesting. It's not directly Nogayev, he's also going to quote you something from the Abarbanel on Sefer Devarim. The Abarbanel was considered to be one of the great systematic expositors of the idea of Moshiach and Geula. So if you want to know a Rishon who addresses all the different stages, I mean, the Rambam does it, but very much B'Kitzur, who addresses all the stages of Mashiach, Olam Haba, Binyan Beis Hamikdash, Kibbutz Goliath, the wars of Gog U'Magog, the Abarbanel does it primarily through three books. He literally wrote three commentaries on the Book of Daniel, which spells out these ideas of Gula. And it is said that because the Jews had been so successful in Spain, both in Ruchnius and in Gashmius, they saw the expulsion as a tragedy, as a cataclysmic tragedy that must have been heralded the growth of Moshiach. That is why the Kabbalah of the Ari is in the generation right after that, because they saw in that tragedy the seeds of Moshiach. The Abarbanel was not a Mekubal, but he too developed his messianic philosophy as a response to the tragedies of the expulsion of the Jews of Spain. But be it as it may, that's just Agav Sishinah, who the Abarbanel is. But in the Hakdamah to the Book of Devarim, he also has introductions to every Sefer, he addresses the question, how do I reconcile these two ideas, that every letter of the Torah has to come from Hashem, with the statement in the Gemara Megillah that the Book of Devarim are Moshe Rabbeinu's own words? Hashem didn't tell them. Moshe Rabbeinu's own words. So the Abarbanel says we have to differentiate in the written Torah between the spoken word and the written word. For example, we say every word in the Torah comes from God. Well, in the Torah, we have all sorts of speakers. We have Para, who says things. We have Lavan, who says things. We have Korach, who says things. Did Hashem tell them ahead of time, hey Korach, read from this script and stand a little to the left of that crack in the ground, and it's going to be a real interesting dramatic effect that's going to happen? And Korach is holding his script and saying, well, who made you the leader? Now, Paro, Lavan, were these people told ahead of time what they're supposed to say? Obviously not. They said what they said. They exercised their Bechirah. And Korach, in theory, of course, this raises all sorts of philosophical questions. The Torah, on one hand, predated the creation of the world, and yet the individual tzaddikim and rishayim, both in terms of what they said and in terms of what they did, must have had free will. That's a real hard question. I'm not going to answer that now, but nevertheless, we do know there was free will. Certainly, Hashem didn't tell Korach what to say. Hashem didn't, well, Paro might be different because Hashem hardened Paro's heart, but even in the case of Paro, Hashem hardened Paro's heart only for the latter five makos. The first five makos, Paro hardened his own heart. So, if Paro's words are Paro's words, and Laban's words are Laban's words, then how does it come from God? The Abarbanel says, this is really a question if you think about it, when we say it comes from God, God determined which of those words should be written down in the Torah. Paro may have said many things. Laban may have said many things. But nothing gets written down in the Torah until God dictates, write it down. So when we say every letter of the Torah is from Hashem, we are referring to the fact that nothing was written in the Torah until Hashem dictated to Moshe, write it down. But at the time that people said things and people did things, it was not Hashem told them ahead of time what they should say. This is what they decided. But Hashem memorialized it. Hashem eternalized it. Hashem made it part of the Torah by telling Moshe Rabbeinu what to write down. Now, based on this idea, which really is fairly obvious if you think about it, we can understand the difference between the book of Devarim and the other four books of the Chumash. In the four books of the Chumash, Hashem told Moshe first, Moshe, this is what I want you to tell B'nai Israel. And Moshe is doing nothing more than giving over the words of God. That is the meaning of the pasuk that we say over and over again. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. Now in English, that word lemor is translated as a superfluous word. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying. It's the equivalent of quotation marks, which we don't have in Hebrew, although modern Hebrew puts them in. But literally, what it means is this. Hashem said to Moshe, lemor, to tell B'nai Israel. Hashem gave Moshe the script. Hashem told Moshe, this is what you should say. The book of Devarim, by contrast, are Moshe Rabbeinu's own words. In other words, these words are Moshe Rabbeinu's words. They are not Hashem's exact words, but they are from Hashem in the sense that afterwards, Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to write them down. So nothing is written in the Torah that is not in Pi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but that's on the level of the writing. That's not on the level of the saying. In the rest of the Torah, Hashem tells Moshe what to say and Moshe says it. In the book of Devarim, it is Moshe Rabbeinu's own words, which Hashem then incorporates in the Torah by the tzivoy to write it down. The Rabbeinu is machalek between the oral verbalization of the Torah, which could be anybody's words at any given time, and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu authorizes to be written down, in which that has to be al pi Hashem. Now you do know that there is a machlokas even regarding the writing down of the Torah. There is one Monte Amor in the Gemara that says Moshe did not write down the whole Torah, because the last eight psukim of the Torah, we're going to read on Sukkot Torah, talk about Moshe dying. Who wrote those words? According to one Monte Amor, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote up until that point, and the last eight verses were written by Yehoshua ben Nun. There's another opinion that Moshe wrote those words ahead of time in tears. They were crying, etc. That's my focus regarding the last days. By the way, one other point about this, although this is general, it's not connected to the parsha, but it's worthwhile to know. When was the Sefer Torah written? Now here we run into a certain problem, and that is we say that Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah on Har Sinai. Now what do we mean by he got the Torah? Moshe Kibel Torah V'Sinai, yes, that means the written Torah, the oral Torah, that we know, and that's not the question I'm raising. I'm raising a simple question. When did we get the book, the five books of Moses, the Sefer Torah? And here's our problem. If we say that Moshe Rabbeinu got the Sefer Torah V'Sinai, First of all, that's not what the Torah says. The Torah says when Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from Har Sinai, he comes down with Luchos, the tablets that have the Ten Commandments. The first ones he broke, and the second ones he didn't break, but that's what it says. He came down with the Luchos HaBris. It does not say he came down with the Sefer Torah. But also, you'd run into a problem similar to the script that I mentioned before, and that is, Matan Torah occurs in the middle of the Torah, middle of Shmos, really, 3 months after we left Egypt. And there are so many things that happen after Matan Torah, whether it's the Chayda Egel itself, after the first Matan Torah, the Meraglim, Korach. So to say that we got the Torah about those events before it happened would once again create the illogical situation that Am Yisrael was reading off a script with the Korach, Meraglim, and it would also take away the concept of free will. So as a result, you have to understand the following. The claim, not the claim, our belief, that Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah B'Sinai does not refer to the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. Torah in that Maimer Chazal refers to mitzvahs. Hashem gave Moshe the 613 mitzvahs, even those that the Jewish people didn't hear about until later. Moshe got the 613 mitzvahs. When was there a Sefer Torah? That's actually a machlokes in the Gemara. Maseches Gittin, maybe some of you will get to it. It's the end of the fifth Perek HaMitzvot, where one Mandi Omar says, Torah, Megillah, Megillah, Mitzvah. Megillah means a scroll at a time. The Torah was written in a piecemeal fashion. By that we mean, after every event happened, Hashem told Moshe, this is what you should write. So after Korach, he wrote the story of Korach, Al-Pi Hashem. After Meraglim, he wrote the story of Meraglim. Meaning the Torah was written gradually over 40 years. And let's say from Bereishis until Matan Torah, that was written at the time of Matan Torah itself. Everything else was piecemeal. Which means, if you would have been one of the Jews in the desert for 40 years, now I'm not sure, one thing I'm not sure of myself is, were these piecemeal sections of the Torah available to the general public, or were they only Moshe Rabbeinu's private possession until the whole Sefer was completed? That I'm not sure. If you wanted to check out and see, gee, how did Hashem describe the story of Korach? I'm not sure if you would have access to it. But according to one opinion, the Torah was written piecemeal over a 40-year period. According to another opinion, the Torah was not written down until the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, when Hashem dictated everything from Bereishis to the end of the Torah, or maybe until the last eight verses, depending on that question. And that was a very busy day for Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, according to that opinion, on the last day of his life, 13 Sifrei Torah. 13 Sifrei Torah, the last day of his life, which is the 7th of Adar, because one Sefer Torah was put in the Aron HaKodesh with the Luchos. And that actually is interesting. That became the master copy. You know, they must have it in Israel too, but I know in the United States, they have something called the Bureau of Standards, which means all measurements, the official inch. How much is an inch? You know, how much is a foot? So they have this laser beam, that's exactly it. So if you're not sure, if you're off a little bit, you gotta measure it exactly. So the truth is, we had an official Sefer Torah. The official Sefer Torah, which we had during the whole first Mikdash, was the Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu himself wrote and put into the Aron HaKodesh. And it's brought down, interestingly enough, that even though it was in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, and only the Kohen Gadol could enter the Kodesh HaKodeshim on Yom Kippur, if for whatever reason there was a contradiction or a discrepancy among Torah scrolls, they were permitted, actually Kohen Gadol would be permitted even in the middle of the year to go into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, take out that Torah, check it against whatever copy they had. That was the official Torah. Now Moshe Rabbeinu wrote 13 of them, one to each tribe. Now I once heard, and I'm looking, people always ask me, the Mucker is, and I cannot find the Mucker. I thought it was the Mabit, I couldn't find it there. You know, one of the difficult issues people raise, well, people on one hand make a good point of it, but then there's a little bit of a caveat. They make a point that if you look at all the Torah scrolls in the world, which have been handed down as a tradition, you find that they're 99.9% all the same. So that shows you it must be a divine transmission. If it would be a human transmission, you would find all sorts of discrepancies and differences. And this is one of the proofs people often say, the Torah comes from God, and that is why it is preserved exactly. Problem is, though, 99.9 is not the same as 100%. And in fact, there are differences. They are small differences. They don't change the meaning of psukim. On the other hand, if we believe everything is from God, then even a change that doesn't seem to change anything has infinite importance, right? You can't do it both ways. You can't say, oh, it comes from God, those are minor differences. Well, no. If it comes from Hashem, then an extra above or an extra yod or an ayin instead of a hey, I'm sorry, an aleph instead of a hey, but suadaka, you can't. Now, I don't know what's important, why that's important. Chazal don't always tell us, but it's got to be important. So how do you explain the... Now, it is very small, that's true. It is very small. Eight differences at a maximum. But eight differences are eight differences. How do you explain that? And in fact, the Gemara says there might even be more. The Gemara even says more dramatically that Bizman HaZeh, you know, we have in the Sefer Torah something called Chaseros and Yeseros. Sometimes you have extra letters. For example, Aharon. Aharon is sometimes spelled with a vav after the resh, Aharon, which is called Malay. By the way, modern Hebrew, for some reason, is notoriously Malay. They put these extra vavs in everywhere. And other times, it is chaser, alatei resh nun, without. Now, is there a difference in meaning? No, but sometimes the Torah spells it this way. Sometimes the Torah spells it that way. So let's say we're laying the Sefer Torah, and the Aharon is supposed to be Malay and it's Chaser. Or it's supposed to be Chaser and it's Malay. So technically the Torah is Pasuk. But the Ramah brings, based on the Gemara in Kedushin, that Bizman HaZeh, we do not replace a Torah scroll because of Chaser and Malay, because we no longer have a reliable tradition. What is Chaser and what is Malay? And therefore, maybe the mistaken one is correct. Meaning to say, the one that we think is mistaken might be the right one, and the one we think is right might be the wrong one. So there's no purpose in replacing. This is what the Ramah says. The Ramah says. So how do you understand that? If the Torah comes from God, how do we make those mistakes? So I heard this, but I cannot find it. So don't ask me where it is. I'm still looking at myself. That it could be the following. Every deviation has great, great significance. But it might be that when Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the primary Sefer Torah, and he wrote 12 other Torahs for each Shevet, Al Pi Hashem, each Shevet had a slightly different Sefer Torah. Now, we don't know exactly why, but based on their particular Avodas Hashem, there was a tiny little bit of discrepancy that Reuven's Torah reflected a different wavelength than Shimon's Torah. And although fundamentally it's 99.9% the same, but the differences might reflect not mistakes in translation. Not mistakes, but deliberate remnants. And since we don't know our Shvatim, so we have to try to go with the standard Torah and the like. Now the Arizal says this in less of a major context. He says that this is the origin of the different nuschos of Tefillah. Like we have Ashkenazim and Sephardim and Taimanim, and, you know, different, Yetis daven one way, Polish Ashkenazim daven a different way. What is the origin of all of these different Yishchais? So the Arizal says that the origin was that the Mishnah in Maseches Midos, which is about the dimensions of the Beis HaMikdash, tells us that there were 13 gates to the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. 13 gates. And the way it worked was, every Shevet had its own unique gate to enter the Beis HaMikdash. But if you didn't know your Shevet, you went into gate 13, because that was for everybody. So the Ari said, with Ruach HaKodesh, every tribe, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah did the basic siddur, but every Shevet had a unique portal to enter Hashem, and that was a reflection of the Mesoros, but of course today we don't know our Shvatim. So Ashkenaz Sfar, these are remnants. These are remnants of Nuschais HaTfila that used to be different for every Shevet. And the Arizal claimed that if you didn't know your Shevet, Nusach Ari was gate 13. That would work for everybody. That's why the Arizal said you should have a Nusach Ari. Problem is, we don't know what Nusach Ari is. I mean, the problem is that all Nusach Sfarad, well, that's a little complicated. You know, Nusach Sfarad is really more complicated than Nusach Ashkenaz, because Nusach Sfarad means at least two different things, and really much more than two different things. There is what is called the Eidut HaMizrach. The Eidut HaMizrach is the Nusach of Jews from Syria, Morocco, Algeria, North Africa, Egypt, right? These are the ethnic Sfarim, you would call them. That is called Eidut HaMizrach. But then there is the Nusach Sfarad that Hasidim daven, which is really a Nusach Ashkenaz that incorporated some things from Sfarad based on the Arizal. So Nusach Sfarad or Sfardic Nusach that Hasidim daven is not Eidut HaMizrach. It actually is Ashkenaz with some Sfardic variations. But be it as it may, and then of course we have Yemenites, and which have a separate Nusach, and some Nusach Sfarad is inspired by Kabbalah and the Ari, and some Nusach Sfarad is not connected to Kabbalah. The Yemenites have two different Nusach. Yeah.
Just two questions. The
Well, there is a question, because the 10 tribes were exiled more than 100 years before the Korban of the first Beis HaMikdash. The Ajik Nesus Abdullah were not around until the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. So the Pashtus, the 10 tribes, were not around as a separate kingdom. But many say that there were remnants of the 10 tribes still around, and even today they're still around. When we say the 10 tribes were lost, we mean the kingdom of the 10 tribes were destroyed, but there were remnants of the Aseret HaShevetim. So any Jew today, you might be a Yisachar, you might be a Zebulun, you might be a Reuven. It's not true to say that there are no descendants of the 10 tribes.
And another question was to say that Ashkenaz represents a possible Nusach of Shevet.
Yeah.
So that would mean that Shevet, what Shvatim, were moved certain areas of the world.
Yes, yes, yes. And there is, by the way, I'll tell you this, you know, this is very, very fascinating. I don't want to get into conspiracy theories and like, you know, there was a belief in medieval Europe. You know, it says in the Book of Shoftim, if you ever read, not the parts of the Book of Shoftim, do you remember the story of Pelagish Begiva? It's a very, very sad and tragic story, in which a concubine was raped and murdered in the tribe of Binyamin, and the whole Jewish nation declared war against the tribe of Binyamin and almost wiped out the Shevets. But it mentioned that there were certain Binyaminites that escaped. They escaped. And in some Midrashim, in Smashma, they escaped to some European countries. It's very, very interesting. In other words, this is way before there was a Beis HaMikdash. This is before the first Beis HaMikdash. And there actually is a tradition, a secular non-Jewish tradition, not secular, but a Christian non-Jewish tradition, that the monarchs of England are somehow descended from those Benjaminites that fled. There is something in the coronation. I haven't looked at this recently, but in the coronation ceremony, the crown jewels that they give, there is something that signifies King of the Jews or something like that. There's something that's in there. Now, the emesis, I have no idea if that's true. If you look at the Da Vinci Code and stuff, they get into that business that business as well. But I will tell you that there's a Targum Yainison that says on the Psukim in Shoftim that there was a large group of Binyaminites that did flee to some European countries, and they remained there, and they never rejoined the Jewish people in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Arizal says, therefore, that this whole debate, what is the best Nusach, Ashkenaz, Sfarad, he says, really is besides the point, because all of them have Kedusha, because they represent tribal Nusachis. So what I had seen, and that's what I had heard B'Shem Gemar Bish, but I can't find it, is the Rambam wants to suggest, this is more daring, because this is not just Mitzvah Tefila, this is the Sefer Torah Hashem, that even these relatively small number of discrepancies in the Torah scroll can be connected to tribal variations. That Reuben's Torah was a shtickle different than Shimon's Torah. Of course, that underscores the fundamental idea that within the community of Am Yisrael there was individuality, but I think that even in some differences in the Torah scroll that exist. Now, of course, we totally don't know the significance of those differences, but apparently there would be deep differences. So anyway, but nevertheless, we do believe it is all Al Pi Hashem, and therefore discrepancies are not a matter of mistake. By the way, Taisus and Menachos asks a very interesting kasha. You'll remember that Shabbos Mincha, after we say Chazaras Hashatz, Shabbos Mincha, we say a paragraph, Sivkascha Tzedek. Right? And Sivkascha Tzedek are three psukim from Tehillim. And what we are doing is, this is called Siduk Hadin. What is Siduk Hadin? We are justifying the righteousness of the Almighty's judgment. And Olavaya, we do Siddiq Adin, I accept the justice of Hashem. Why do you do Siddiq Adin on Shabbos? Because it's brought down that there were three great tzaddikim who were nifter Shabbos Mincha. One was Yosef, a tzaddik. One was Moshe Rabbeinu. And the third was David HaMelech. So we have a Messiah. Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos. So Fred Taisa said, Menachas and Gevaldik Akasha, how can I say Moshe Rabbeinu wrote 13 Sifrei Torah on the day that he died? Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos. He certainly would not write on Shabbos. So Tosfos says a big chiddush, and I don't think it will apply to any of us, but Taisa says a chiddush ba'alacha, that since to write 13 Sifrei Torah was a maaseh nes, you can't do it normally. It's supernatural. It's utilizing Nisim to do it. So Tosfos says a malacha that is done al yedei nes is not prohibited on Shabbos. So if you know how to do something, of course, you're not allowed to use magic, though. That's the thing. So whatever it would be. But if you could get Hashem to do a nes for you, a nes does not have a shame malacha, and that is why Moshe Rabbeinu was allowed to write those secrets out. Yeah, you understand? Well, no, he brought Luchos,
right,
which have the Ten Commandments. That's 100% correct. In other words, you see from here that the oral law is much older than the written law. Because if you follow the opinion that none of the Torah, except for the Aseret HaDibros, was written down until the very end, then for 40 years, even the so-called written part of the Torah was only preserved orally. The first makes the point that Torah Shebal Peh is not only concurrent with Torah Shebal Seh, Torah Shebal Peh is older than Torah Shebal Seh, because during the 40 years of the Midbar, you had the Torah Shebal Peh, you did not have the Torah Shebal Seh. Okay, that is a good point. Okay, this is the raya that what you do by a Maisa Neis is not called Macha. By the way, the Ramah brings interesting another. All of us know that we have Suda Shalishis after Mulchet, and Zechiyah to eat Suda Shalishis, but the Ramah brings that there are some in Minhagim that Bedavka, they would not eat anything after Shabbos Mulchet, because they would have a certain amount of mourning, a certain amount of Avelis over the three Tzaddikim that died, and they would be Machayim Suda Shalishis, Bedavka before Mulchet. Now we go the other way around. We ask him that the Zman of Suda Shalishis is after Mulchet. But not only that, the Ramah even brings, this is even more astounding, that some people have a minhag that you're not allowed to learn Torah after Mincha during the time of Suda Shalishis, because since we are commemorating the deaths of these three tzaddikim, we even refrain from learning during the Torah. Again, that's obviously not our minhag, but the Ramah does bring such a minhag. to be mavato. Again, whenever we say mavato, that doesn't mean to sit around and shoot. I mean, that's not, you know, even on Tisha B'Av, that's not really proper. I mean, the truth of the matter is, the Erech HaShulchan actually said, the Erech HaShulchan says that he discusses the issue. On Tisha B'Av, you're not allowed to learn Torah, but some Rishayim extend this to Erev Tisha B'Av after Chatzos. The Erech HaShulchan says, don't be machmir on that. But he says, if he would have the koach, which he doesn't, he would even tell people to learn on Tisha B'Av because it's a lot better than what they do as an alternative. I mean, Chazal didn't say, spend the day schmoozing, you know, but don't learn. You know, that wasn't really that really wasn't the point. But okay, be it as it may.
So before you're speaking about yourself, I heard a few times that they say that because we're in Israel, we should pray the Mizrach. It's like a general...
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. You know, Rabbi Raji Yosef, who was certainly one of the Gedolei Ador of everybody, but in particular, was certainly the Gedolei Ador for Sfarad and Mizrach and Mizrach, he took the following interesting halachic position. He took the halachic position that there ought not to be Ashkenazim in Eretz Yisrael at all. And his argument was, he says, he can't change that evil, he's kind of stuck with it, but he says, there ought not to be Ashkenazim. Because what happened was this, Sfardim were here much longer. Because Sfardim, if you went back in the middle of the 1800s, before the Vilna Gaon's Talmidim, there were no Ashkenazim here at all. It was only Sfardim. So when the first Ashkenazim came, it's like anyone else. If I move into a kehila, and this kehila follows certain minhagim, I am mechuyev to follow those minhagim. This is called kama kama batel, meaning every Ashkenazic that came should have become batel to the minhagim of the Sfarim. Now, eventually what happened was, Ashkenazim got bigger and bigger in number, and today, I don't have the exact numbers, but you know, there's roughly equal Ashkenazim and Sfarim in Eretz Yisrael. But Rabbi Raja made the argument that each little group of Ashkenazim were mechuyev to become Sfarim when they came to the Kehila, and therefore he said that Rabbi Yosef Kairo, as opposed to the Ramah, is not only the definitive posek for Sfarim, but he should be the definitive posek for Ashkenazim as well. But this was his position. And some people say that. That's not the way most people follow. We basically feel every Kehila should follow its Ramah. So if you're Taimani, you'd be a Taimani. If you're a Chabad, you're Chabad. If you're Yeki, you're Yeki. And we believe that each of these minhagim has a beauty. That's why the debate, you know, you can write all sorts of debates. Is Nesach Hashanah better than Sfarad? Is it not better than Sfarad? Some sages say Ashkenaz was the original Nesach. The Ari is quoted to say Sfarad was the original Nesach. And then there's the Machlokas. Listen, even the Ari, there are two shows in Sfarad. There's the Ari Ashkenaz and Sfarad. You know, so there's a lot of uncertainty here. The bottom line is, of most posting, is all nuschais have their makar in Kedusha, particularly if you connect it to the Shvatim, and therefore every nusach has its chashiva and should not be bothered.
So the mitzvahs in Sefer Devarim were only revealed at that time. They weren't mechadish
before. So now let's talk about this. So what did Moshe get at Sinai? Right, he wrote down, he chiseled in stone the second luchos. Actually, he didn't chisel it. He chiseled the tablets. Hashem wrote down the second luchos. The second luchos Hashem wrote down, not Moshe. And Moshe got mitzvos, but the narrations weren't written until later. But we still believe Moshe Rabbeinu got the 613 mitzvos at Sinai. Now, even that needs a certain explanation. Because we see so many commandments that the Jewish people don't get until later. Right? Devarim. Right? We have get, the mitzvah of get. Moshe Rabbeinu is telling the Jewish people about a get one month before his death. So the Chazon Ish is masbir that we have to differentiate between when did Moshe get mitzvah and when did Bnei Yisrael get mitzvah. Moshe kibel Torah Nisina. Moshe hears from Hashem 613 mitzvahs besim. But Hashem tells him to reveal it to the Bnei Yisrael over the course of 40 years. And some mitzvahs were not revealed until the end of the 40 years. Again, that's how the Chazon Ish understands the Torah, in which the revelation of mitzvahs to Am Yisrael not as seen. Some were, but it was throughout 40 years. And in fact, the Chazon Ish is mashmir with this. He gives a tremendous chiddush. We find a number of places in the Torah where Moshe Rabbeinu did not know what the halacha was. In fact, there are four places in the Torah where Moshe Rabbeinu was uncertain what the halacha was. One was the punishment of the Mekoshesh, the guy that gathers wood on Shabbos. Moshe Rabbeinu knows a Mechalel Shabbos gets the death penalty, but he doesn't know which form of death. And he has to ask Hashem, and Hashem says, stoning. Wasn't that given to Sinai? Okay. The second is a similar incident, Mekalel. There's a man that has an Egyptian father and a Jewish mother, and he curses Hashem. Moshe didn't know the Onesh, so once again the punishment is stoning. That's Megadeth, Mekalel. The third is Pesach Sheni. People were Tamei. They didn't know. They couldn't bring the Korban Pesach. They thought they'd have no chance. Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem, and Hashem says, if a person is Tamei, when it's time to bring the Korban Pesach, they have a month later to bring Pesach Sheni. And the fourth, which is the most recent one we had, is the daughters of Tzlacha. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu knows that when there's a son and a daughter, the son inherits and not the daughter. But he didn't know the din. What if a daughter, and there's no son, does a daughter inherit, or does it go to the brothers, the uncles? So he has to ask Hashem. Right? Four situations where Moshe Rabbeinu did not know the halacha. And the question is, what do we mean he didn't know the halacha? Didn't Hashem tell him the halacha on Har Sinai? Moshe Kibel Torah Misina. How can we say he didn't know until Hashem tells him later? Now, some Ma'amari Chazal actually say Moshe must have known the halacha, but he had forgotten it. Hashem had punished him in various ways for anger. So there is a sheet in Chazal that say, of course, Moshe at one point knew the halacha, but Hashem made him forget it to teach him. It's hard to say teach Moshe modestly. That's very, very difficult to understand. Moshe Rabbeinu was already the Anav Nikalada, but still, it was a Moshe. But the Chazon Ish has an amazing approach. The Chazon Ish says like this. Moshe knew the answers to everything. But the problem was he didn't know what to do when he was in possession of inside information that he was not yet given the green light to reveal to Am Yisrael. Because here's the problem. In Parshas Vayakel, Moshe was authorized to tell the Jewish people, anyone who desecrates Shabbos gets Misa. But he was not yet authorized to tell Bnei Yisrael which death. He knew, but he wasn't yet authorized. So now, a Maisa Shehaya happens that somebody's Chai of Misa. The Chazon Ish says, Moshe Rabbeinu's quandary is, what do I do when the halacha requires the application of knowledge that I have, but which I was not yet authorized to reveal to Am Yisrael? He asks Hashem and gets the green light, now you can reveal it. So the Chazon Ish says, this was the problem with Pesach Sheni. It was not yet revealed. This was the problem with Menos Salavcha. This was the problem with the Megadeth. So Gevaldik Pshat, because basically Moshe Rabbeinu got those mitzvahs. He knew those mitzvahs. He knew the halacha. But, now again, I know I'm not answering the fundamental question. Why is Hashem keeping all these secrets? It's hard to know for us to understand why and what causes HaKadosh Baruch Hu to decide when we need to hear something and when we don't, and why we only hear it partially and not completely. But the Chazon Ish points out, Kachi Seder HaTorah, because it's clear when you read the Torah, the Jewish people got mitzvos in different times. On one hand we say, Moshe got everything to Sinai. On the other hand, we didn't get everything to Sinai. We get everything over a period of time, and the Chazon Ish says that it was the Ratzon Hashem that the mitzvos get revealed to Am Yisrael as a result of different circumstances over the 40 years of the desert. So in Parshas Kisetze, we have Gittin, and we have Yibam, and we have Eishes Shepas Torah. All of these are new commandments. Moshe got them to Sinai, but now he is told to reveal them for the first time. Okay. So that's, again, something to think about. So the notion of Torah miSinai is a complicated notion, both in terms of narratives and in terms of mitzvahs. So you have to differentiate between Torah min haShamayim and Torah miSinai. Torah min haShamayim is simple. That simply says everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nothing is made up. But Torah miSinai, that's a little more complicated, because we didn't hear everything to Sinai. Moshe Rabbeinu got it, but the Torah wasn't written down until later, and even the different commandments were not always given us until later. So Torah miSinai and Torah min haShamayim are not the same thing. Because min haShamayim is the idea that it all comes from Hashem. miSinai is the particular place that Hashem gave it to us. And that already can have different interpretations. Okay, so this is kind of just a general point to keep in mind.
Okay.